This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Welcome to the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. My name is Raymond Grenfell. Joining me in the studio is Brent Jones. How's it going, Brent?
Going well, Ray. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Before we get started, though, huge thanks and love to Jeff for another excellent edition of On The Record. He'll be back next week, but of course you can catch On The Record every weekday here at RTRFM from 9 in the AM. As I said, this is the Indie Media Show. We're with you on the airwaves until about 12 o'clock when Out To Lunch comes on the radio. But yeah, we're covering all the sort of activist media, citizen journalism kind of thing, as I'm sure you're aware if you've tuned into the show over the last 17 odd years. On today's show, we've actually, for unusual circumstances and for a bit of a change, we've got some kind of good news. A couple of rare positive announcements from the state government recently. Up first, we're going to be chatting about the announcement by the McGowan government to end native logging in our southwest or in our state by 2024. We're going to be chatting to our regular guest on the Indie Media Show, Jess Beckling from the Western Australian Forest Alliance, about that, the implications for it, and I guess, you know, what it means for our forests, but also whether or not the struggle and the fight is over. There's still things such as, the mining and the destruction caused by projects such as some of the Alcoa mines that will be impacting greatly on our forests. And I guess there's also a bit of a worry that in the next couple of years, that as happened in Tasmania when they announced an end to some of their logging, a lot of the timber industry will really try and smash as much as they can in the next couple of years. So we'll be chatting a bit about that up first on the show.
And then I caught up this week via the phone with a gentleman who's in the detention centre at Brisbane Airport after failing the 501 character test, which is a bit of a situation around the country that a lot of people are getting caught up with. 12-month cumulative prison sentence, and if you're not an Australian citizen, permanent resident, or under that, you're done. You're straight to detention, and some of the processes involved in that are very loose. Mm. There's and it's generally not being covered by mainstream media. They won't touch it.
Yeah, I was about to say it's kind of a very unknown sort of story in a way, unfortunately. And these are people that, you know, if they've received criminal convictions, they've served their time, but now they're effectively in indefinite detention and they're stateless, being, you know, detained in our detention centres potentially forever.
So for some people, yeah, depending on where they've come from. The person I spoke to is Iranian originally, and they can't go back there. So essentially there's nowhere else for them to be but detention based on these loose laws. But it's all sorts of people that are caught up in this. A lot of New Zealand citizens that are here on permanent residency who otherwise wouldn't have thought that they would be in danger of ending up in detention are there. You know, all sorts of people, English. I've even heard some stories about people that were born here, but have somehow ended up losing citizenship in rare cases, which it's important to shine a light on, I think.
Totally. We're also going to be chatting about, talking a little earlier about the positive announcement of the McGowan government around native forests. There's also been a bit of a win in terms of the homelessness crisis here, with an announcement of over 3,000 new public homes. So we're going to be chatting to Indie Media presenter and homelessness rights advocate Jesse Noakes a little later in the show to find out what's happening in regard to that. As he said, it's not enough, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. So we'll be finding out about that a little later in the show. So lots of reasons to keep it locked to RTRFM this morning for the Indie Media Show, with myself, Ray, Brent, and also Brahma in the studio keeping up the positive vibes. But to kick things off, we're going to go to a relatively new track from Sleaford Mods. This is off their fairly recently released Spare Ribs album. This is Shortcomings. You're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1, The Sound Alternative. Sleaford Mods on RTR FM 92.1 with their track Shortcomings. Now, it's quite rare on the Indie Media Show that we actually get to discuss something relatively positive. Unfortunately, over the last while that this program's been on the air, usually we have to come on the air every Monday and talk about sort of depressing news about how the world's gotten worse, how some sort of biodiversity is under threat, or the government's put innocent people in prison or gone off to war somewhere else. So it is, I guess, a bit of a surprise and a pleasure to actually announce and discuss something a lot more positive, and that is the WA government announcing that they will be ending or putting a stop to most native logging in 2024. On the phone now, we have Jess Beckling from the West Australian Forest Alliance to discuss this news. Firstly, I'd just like to say a huge congratulations to yourself, Jess, and everyone else at WAFER for all the years of and decades, really, of work that you've put into this. So first up, huge congratulations to yourself.
Oh, thanks, Ray. I mean, far out. This is a win that belongs to so many thousands of people, and such heartfelt work, that's gone into it over decades.
Totally. Now, I guess before we sort of start to unpack it all, can you just give us a brief, summary of what exactly this means? The government has announced they're going to put $350 million into softwood plantations, and that at least in the southwest, all native logging would end in 2024. What exactly does it mean for our forests?
It's a huge breakthrough. It's absolutely massive. I mean, the native forest logging industry has been having catastrophic impacts on climate and wildlife, biodiversity, water, cultural values ever since it started here in WA. And it's finally coming to an end. So we've got 2 and a bit years to go until it stops. And that's because we're still within the 10-year forest management plan until the end of December 2023. But then from January 2024, when the next 10-year plan starts, there's not going to be any further logging of native forests.
And is that only in the southwest or all throughout the state?
Well, it's a policy that applies to the whole state, but the tall forests that are being logged for timber are in the southwest.
Right. Now, I guess some of our listeners would be maybe a little bit suspicious because, those of us that are old enough would, of course, remember the Gallup government's victory in 2001 and the promise to end old growth logging. Of course, we know that wasn't really an end to old growth logging. And unfortunately, we live in a world in which, while, we really want to be positive about this, there are, of course, the possibilities and the chances that these are politicians being politicians. Are you confident that this really will mean an end to all native logging in the state?
Yeah, look, you're spot on. And the most seasoned campaigners, old friends and colleagues of mine from around the country, that was exactly the tone that they were taking when they were texting me first thing on Wednesday morning. I'm holding my breath here a little bit. Is this real? And it's a perfectly reasonable thing for people to be doing in the circumstances. We've got to bite this sort of stuff off in chunks. And this announcement doesn't mean that all of our southwest forests are now completely protected from all threats, of course. And there's always going to be work to do. There's always going to be advocacy around protecting the incredible intrinsic values of the southwest forests. What this does is deal with native forest logging for timber production. So it's what it means is that we're not going to be seeing the Karri and Jarrah forests and Wandoo forests being logged in order to supply largely low-value timber products and the timber industry more broadly. So we're still going to have to deal with the threat of Alcoa and South 32 and other mining interests, particularly in the Jarrah forest. We still have to deal with fire management, and we still have to deal with thinning. So those are the things that we're really going to have our eyes really focused on for the next 2 years to make sure that not only we're able to really minimise the damage that's done in these next 2 years, because that's going to be a major task, but also that the next 10-year plan really sets the details right so that the framework for how the forest is going to be managed is as good as we can possibly make it. Because we've you know, the damage that's been wrought on the Southwest Forests ever since European settlement here has been profound. And finally, we're in a situation where we have a government saying the forests are worth more for climate and biodiversity, and we're all facing in the same direction, but now the task is to get the details right and actually make sure that that 10-year plan protects the forest's values.
We're speaking to Jess Beckling from the West Australian Forest Alliance about the recent announcement by the McGowan government to end native logging in the state. Jess, you mentioned there that, you know, there are 2 years to go, and I guess many of our listeners would be aware of the situation that occurred in Tasmania when they ended some, you know, I guess old growth logging there. There was a real, I guess, kind of snatch and grab by the forestry industry in Tasmania in the lead up to the sort of the moratorium on logging there. Do you foresee that kind of thing happening in the next couple of years? Are you concerned and worried that, you know, some players in the industry will think, well, let's just get in there and destroy as much as we can, get as much timber out as we can before this comes into effect?
Yeah, I think it's a complex area, and there's a lot of different things, you know, that could be said about that. I think initially the what the policy setting is going to be is important. So we know that the government's not going to increase allocations. They're not going to allow for any extra logging to occur in the next 2 years. But at this stage, they're also not talking about proactively buying out any of the companies so that the logging can decline. They're talking about just letting it run its course for the next 2 and a bit years and then calling it to an end. So what we can anticipate, at least from a kind of a broad perspective, is that the same sorts of volumes will be coming out per year, which is about 6,500 hectares being logged per year. So it's still a huge area. But we can also anticipate that without really close monitoring, there may well be some particularly heavy-handed logging going on, in the next couple of years in those forests. So we want to make sure that a couple of things happen. One is that the most precious areas for threatened species, Aboriginal cultural values, water values, those sorts of things are taken off logging plans immediately. And then also that there's really close scrutiny applied to those individual logging operations to keep the contractors as close as possible to the industry's own guidelines, which have always been completely inadequate. But at least we need to be making sure that as little damage is done as possible in each of those individual forests.
Jess, one of the arguments that's made against winding up the sort of forestry industries and also other destructive and unsustainable industries is the impact on livelihoods, the impact on the communities in which these industries exist. The government has announced that there'll be a huge investment into softwood plantation timber. Do you think that there is going to be a just transition, as people refer to it, for the families and the workers that have been working in forestry industries, and how important is that in terms of making sure that this is a sustainable transition and actually does go through?
Yeah, it's critically important, and WAFE has been taking this really seriously for a long time, and we put together the Forest for Life plan in 2016. And I think the government, they're doing a really solid job of saying they've got $350 million, which is the biggest investment that's ever gone into the softwood estate. It's going to grow a lot of timber on previously cleared land. There's not going to be any more land clearing for those trees to be planted, and it's going to create a lot of jobs. And then there's another $50 million that they've put into helping those individual workers to transition. We're talking about around 400 people who are still employed in native forest logging. So it's really important that they're taken care of and that job is done well. And then, we also know that there's a whole lot of other people in the Southwest in tourism and accommodation, agriculture, horticulture, wine growing, honey production, people who have been calling out for the forest to be protected for a really long time because they need them protected for their livelihood. So I think it's really important that we kind of draw the lens back and look at the whole socioeconomic set of circumstances in the Southwest. We need to take care of those timber workers, and we need to transition them over to sustainable timber production and other sustainable jobs. But we also need to think more broadly about all of the other people in the Southwest, and the vast majority of them are benefiting from this decision.
Jess, Brent Jones here. Obviously, the huge success of influencing government with your campaign through West Australian Forest Alliance. What is next when it comes to Alcoa? Like that's, they've got big contracts with the government and are able to clear this. How do we battle that beast?
It's so important. So there's a couple of ways, and the most important one is coming up soon. The EPA are going to be scrutinising an expansion proposal that Alcoa have put up for a further 8,500 hectares of Jarrah forest that they want to clear for bauxite mining between 2025 and 2035. And this is the first time in my lifetime that there has been such scrutiny applied to bauxite mining. So starting around about the middle of December, there's going to be a public environmental review, which is the highest level of EPA review, opened to public consultation, and we're going to have a couple of months for the public to be able to really make a huge amount of noise around how important it is that those forests are protected. And also the EPA have now sort of shifted the way that they assess projects like this. They're also able to look at the cumulative impacts of different projects and different time frames of what's been going on in the Jarrah Forest altogether. So instead of just looking at the next 8,500 hectares, they can look at what's happened in the Jarrah Forest over the years. So that's going to be really important. It's going to be a different framing and a different way for us to be able to emphasise what the impact has been and how precious the remaining bits of the Jarrah Forest are. So it's really important that people get behind that, and we'll be making it really simple and clear for people, letting them know, you know, when it's starting and what the opportunities are. So we'd encourage people to follow us on Facebook, WA Forest Lines, and also the Jarrahdale Forest Mob and the Dwelling Up Forest Mob, who are doing incredible work to keep Alcoa to account.
Jess, mentioning there the public comment and public review, this latest announcement in terms of protecting our native forests came after the survey that was put out by the state government. That is quite amazing, and I think really important to mention that some 17,000 people took that survey. It wasn't a particularly easy survey to take, and 17,000 people did that. Well, it really demonstrates the will in the community to save our native forests. But also, I think it's important to mention that this isn't necessarily a benevolent action from our state government. This has come about from decades and decades of campaigning. And I guess just, you know, to finish off, what more can people do? Where to now for the campaign? Of course, you mentioned there Alcoa and the importance of people getting involved in the campaign to stop that destruction. But what else can people do who are concerned about our native forests and our forests here in Western Australia?
Yeah, Alcoa is a massive one, and the other two are fire. Fire management is critically important. You know, fire has been a part of this landscape for a very long time, and we've changed the way that it's applied dramatically in the last couple of hundred years, and we need to fix that. There needs to be an independent review. We need much better science behind the way that we're managing forests in terms of fire, not just forests, but all of the ecosystems down here. And then also thinning is going to be a major one. So the state government have said that they are still planning to have these management activities that are designed around forest health. So the fine print in that of how they actually manage the areas that are heavily degraded, and that's going to be thinning operations. The detail around what that looks like is going to be absolutely critical. So there's three things. There's clearing, there's thinning, and there's fire. And that we're going to have a lot of opportunity to deal with those in the next couple of years and beyond. But look, you know, a lot of us have been doing this for a really long time, and there's even been people who I've campaigned with who've passed away before we've gotten to this point. This is the kind of work that takes people working from their heart, focused on the needs of the forests and never giving up. And we've got 2 years of hard work ahead of us, and beyond that there's going to be other ways that we can defend forests. It's a community movement, and we've got to stick with it.
We've been speaking to Jess Beckling from the West Australian Forest Alliance. And again, Jess, to yourself and all those involved in Wayfair and all those out there, if you're listening or not, that have spent their time dedicated to saving and defending our native forests, massive love and respect to all of you. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Jess.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. We'll be back soon talking about 501 visas and those languishing in detention in our country, many of them stateless and unable to go anywhere. But right now, here's a track by New Nausea, and this is Swine on RTRFM 92.1.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
You're listening to The Sound Alternative 92.1, the indie media show. My name's Brent and I'm here with Ray. Over the last month, I've been speaking to and trying very hard to find someone to have an interview in regards to the situation around Section 5013A of the Migration Act, which has now been lowered, I think, about 3 years ago to 12 months cumulative sentence or more. Lands you in detention immediately after your prison sentence. And a lot of these people as well don't even have to serve that time. It can be suspended sentence, good behaviour bonds. If it's 12 months or more, they immediately fail that character test. There's all sorts of different people affected. And one of those is a man named Pepper who's currently in the Brisbane Transit Detention Centre, which sits outside Brisbane Airport. So I caught up with him on Wednesday and had a conversation. Here it is.
Yeah, not too bad. Pretty good, thank you.
No worries. So tell us a little bit about your time you've spent in detention, Pepper. How long have you been in there?
Been in here for, it's going on 12 months exactly now, and still haven't had any updates or any answers or anything like that come through. So I'm still on my revocation.
Yeah. So you're completely in the dark as to how long you'll be there. You've heard absolutely nothing from the government.
Absolutely nothing. And being a government corporation, you'd think they'd be pretty transparent and have a list of their procedures for everyone to basically be able to view and see, like every other part of the government is, except for this part, it's totally closed and blind. So you're pretty much here for... I've seen people come and go in 2 months, and I've seen people who've been here for 8 years. So,
yeah, wow.
There's no consistencies or what, you know.
And you know, largely, what kind of people are in there that are affected? Are we talking about all sorts of walks of life, or you know, is there a sort of consistent pattern?
You got all walks. Like, you know what? Like compared to like I've come from prison to here. And when you come into this environment compared to the jail environment, those type of people, it's completely different. Like, these people aren't, like, they're not jail people. You're not here, you're not on your toes, you're not worried about what's going to happen next with any of the other guys. And, like, the population that they have in here, with the restrictions and the security, it's over the top, like, 100-fold. Like there's no need to put us behind two sets of fences, no need to cage us into like separate compounds, and we're not allowed to mix with any other compounds. Like we've got more restrictions here than there is in jail.
Yeah, wow. What are the living conditions like?
The living conditions, they've set the rooms up so there's three bunks, three beds in the bedroom. On this side, it's a little bit more better. It's a little bit better than the other side where I first was, which is meant to be high security. And over there, it's exactly like jail. Like, it's worse than jail. It's actually set up like the detention unit in jail. So it's just one corridor, rooms off either side, and you got a little kitchenette and a little TV room, and that's it.
Yeah.
And the no toilet door, no shower door. The rooms are set up exactly the same as jail. There's no chairs where you can just pull up a chair. Everything's bolted down.
Yeah.
And you're still getting ramps, searched, and all of that shit. So it's exactly the same as jail, except you've got worse conditions. Because for contact visits, we still haven't had, really, we don't have contact visits. Still, like compared to jails have had their visits back for so long, and we're just getting them back now, and still they're under so much restriction where you can't even go buy your visitor a drink and take it up there with them because they don't want any of that. So there's no food to be taken up, no drinks to be taken up, and it's still only one adult at a time that can visit you. So if you've got two, my mum and dad still haven't been able to come visit me because they're elderly and they're not going to drive all this way up to Brisbane by themselves.
So where were you living before you've ended up here? before prison? Gold Coast. Cool.
Yeah.
And what was your visa status or your residency status?
PR, permanent resident.
Permanent resident, yep. And yeah. that's obviously been cancelled?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you currently stateless?
At the moment, yeah. Yeah, because I'm from Iran, and Iran, I don't think Iran's going to even take me back, so...
Do you have access... Do you have access to any assistance with lawyers or legal counsel?
No. They don't provide anything like that. You know, the funny thing about this whole place is, like, even when they do serve you with the papers, they don't even tell you that you can contact Rails and they'll give you a self-help kit, which will guide you through it. So a lot of people, like, I've got someone here... that they didn't hand their paper back in within the 28 days, and that's it. Like, and they've been stuck here for nearly 4 years now because they didn't hand that paper back in on the right time. And the guy, he says he's Australian, and they can't prove that he's not Australian, yet they're still holding him here, so he's still guilty before he's even presumed innocent.
Wow. A lot of the people I've spoken to about or that are going through similar things to you have mentioned about the paperwork that they get when they get 28 days to lodge is that it's getting caught up within the prison mail system itself. So you're not actually even getting the paperwork sometimes until a day or so before that cutoff. Right. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And then it's up to, you know, if you haven't been the ideal prisoner and you've pissed off a guard in there, who's to say that guard actually ever put your paperwork through?
Mm.
A lot of the people which rely on the guards to do that, where you don't have to, you can post it out yourself, which I've always done. I've just been in that situation. I didn't think it's worth risking that, so I just posted it off myself. But I know people that haven't and their paperwork hasn't got through on time. And if that paperwork isn't on time, and if you're from New Zealand or if you're from England, it's very hard for them, for you to have your words even heard anywhere. They'll just chip you out.
Mm. Yeah. And have you been...
No matter how long you've been here.
Have you been in the same detention centre or have they moved you around?
I've been in the same one, but I've been to other detention centres.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been to other detention centres. I've been to Yonga Hill, I've been to Christmas Island, and you know what, this one's probably the worst one out of all of them because they call it a transit centre. You don't have all the facilities and stuff as you would over in Christmas Island. You've got the music room, you've got kitchen, you've got art room. Here, you've got nothing. Like, literally, last year, the whole time I was here, pretty much only... I started to become the delegate for the units over here halfway through last year and battling for just to get some activities and some stuff done so we've got something to do during the day, that they've only just started to provide that stuff like late last year, and it's going to like this year as well, which has got a little bit better, but still compared to the other centres, we're doing double the time compared to what they are.
Mm. Yeah, no good. Is there anything that you'd like to add about the experience or about this whole system?
Look, at the end of the day, the system's just designed. Yeah, you've got the minority of prisoners coming to detention centres, so like, and for the reason why they've been able to get us here is because have gone from the way it first started was between murderers, rapists, anyone that's done 30 years of jail or more, and then it's got cut down to pretty much if we've got any affiliations with any bikies or anything like that, and then yet that's still cut down some more, and now it went to 12 months or more imprisonment, and that doesn't mean that you have to serve the time. Even if it's the custodial sentence you serve in the community, you still get your visa cancelled, and now it's just gone down to character test. So pretty much anyone that's not a citizen, if you get pulled up by the cops, you can pretty much have your visa cancelled. Mm. It's gotten that bad.
Yep. Yeah. And the discretion of that character is on particular judges or ministers?
Well, it's particular. It goes pretty much down to the ministers. And look, the judges, most of the judges aren't for this because it's going over their heads. So if you go get sentenced and then the judge gives you a sentence and then all of a sudden he's doing all of this time as well. Well, the judge feels a bit offended about why his word isn't getting taken and why is it getting over his head. So a lot of judges will show a bit of compassion towards people that have been in this situation. But once you're in this situation, the guys that do the your tribunal and that, you can go there and you can give them all the answers in the world that's right, but mainly they just knock them back. And it's hard to see, like, people have like got families and that just stuck in the situation, and then all of a sudden the whole family is upended and they've got to try to work out how they're going to get overseas and this time with all the COVID and shit like that. They're not compassionate. They say they show compassion towards families and that. Mate, they don't care.
Yep. And when you finished your time in prison, were you immediately taken into custody of Border Force, or did you go home and were you
No. You get released from prison to the hands of Border Force, and then Border Force hand you over to Serco, and they bring you straight to the detention centre.
Yep. Okay. Look, thank you very much for your time, Pepper. Really appreciate you coming on.
Anytime.
Absolutely.
All good. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, mate. Take care, yeah?
Yeah. Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Pepper at the Brisbane Detention Centre. Coming up now, here's Nervous with their banger, Talk.
Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1 with myself, Raymond, also Brent Jones and Brahma, all in the studio, keeping you company until 12 o'clock when Out to Lunch comes on your radio. Now, we did start the show with a pretty positive announcement from the government regarding native forests. In more relatively positive news, there's also been a recent announcement by the state government to build some 3,300 public homes. The issue of the homelessness crisis here in Western Australia is one that we've been covering extensively on this program, especially around the tent cities that have popped up in Fremantle and elsewhere. And joining us now on the phone is Indie Media contributor, journalist and homelessness advocate, or homelessness support advocate, Jesse Noakes. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, Jesse.
Hi, Ray and Brent and Brahma. Good to be with you, as always, Ray.
Now, this, as we said, this issue is something we've been covering extensively on the show. And this announcement of the over 3,000 new public homes, I imagine, is being seen as somewhat of a major win by many in the sector and many of those that have been advocating and organising around this issue for some time. What exactly does this mean for the current homelessness crisis in the state, and how far does it go to address the problem?
Very good question. It is a win for sure. And the announcement came last Sunday. They dropped it very, very quietly around lunchtime on Father's Day, no sort of media in advance. So my take on that is that A, they want the problem to go away, and B, they don't want it to look like they're being forced to make the problem go away. But nonetheless, the 3.5 give or take, 3,500 public houses over the next 4 years is definitely a positive development. It's certainly a massive improvement on nothing, which was the alternative going into this when sort of our campaign kicked off 12 to 18 months ago. I've the shine and it doesn't last for long, to be quite honest. You celebrate the victories, but it comes in the context of an ongoing crisis, as you say. You know, Budget Day on Thursday was terrific, took a bunch of corrupt parliament to celebrate and sort of interrupt the proceedings to ensure that they were front and centre when everyone was giving their 2 cents on the budget announcements. But then over the weekend, I was out with a family who lost someone on the street recently, and, you know, got to their house yesterday afternoon to be told that another daughter had passed away the day prior, someone who we'd worked really closely on a vigil at Parliament recently with. This morning, again, story on the front page of the paper about more people dying on the streets. So while it's definitely wonderful to see the response from the government, especially as a direct result of so many very marginalised people standing together and speaking out and sharing their stories to drive the pressure that delivered the result, it comes too late for too many people, and it's certainly too little to stem the ongoing tragedy. And I think we're just going to see more and hear more about that as we go forward.
Now, what is the current state of play in regard to public housing? I mean, I can only, I guess, speak to it anecdotally, knowing, you know, friends that have spent years and years on Homes West waiting lists trying to get public housing. And that's, I think, a pretty common story amongst people. Will these 3,000 homes change that reality at all? Or, like, you know, what's the current state of play in terms of how many houses are there and how many houses are really needed to ensure that this issue is addressed?
Yeah, so the current state of play is pretty dire. There's 17,000 families on the wait list. 3,500 of those are on the priority wait list, which means they're in immediate crisis right now. That number's doubled in the past 12 months. There are about 36,000 public houses across WA, so this announcement theoretically increases that number by something approaching 10%, which again is significant, 10% over the next 4 years, which is significantly more than the 6% over 10 years, which was the government's previously stated intention, an intention they failed to sort of even begin to enact over the first 4 years of their of McGowan's premiership. They in fact lost a net total of more than 1,300 public houses by knocking over some units and selling off others. So in that context, in the context of, you know, a precipitous decline in public housing stock over the previous 4 years, an intention to redress that and actually get back into the black and start building some homes is a really good sign. But, I mean, you know, the details are always hard to pass for these guys. The numbers kind of get announced and re-announced and re-announced. It's a four-year plan. It's a lot better than nothing. But it's still, it's really... it's a drop in the ocean compared to the ongoing need. And I think one thing that should be kind of acknowledged and identified is that it's literally the bare minimum you would expect from any self-respecting Labor government is to deliver the basics of a social safety net, of which housing is kind of the foundational layer, and that it takes a concerted pressure campaign over more than a year when we've got a $5 billion surplus, one of the only budget surpluses in the world right now, and certainly the strongest WA's ever enjoyed. I don't think we should be under any illusions that this government is serious about dealing with homelessness. They're simply kind of trying to staunch the flow and the damage that they've been kind of been copping recently. And I think it does that. I think politically it sort of, it takes the oxygen out of the issue to some degree, but as I say, there's a huge five-page story on the front page of the West Australian, which I would encourage people to read. It's actually a terrific story about people being released from prison into homelessness and dying there. That's the first of many stories, I would expect. So while a few thousand houses is a decent start, it's it only begins to sort of repair the damage of the past few years, and I'd hope that as this second term of the McGowan government continues, we'll see a lot more of it.
We're speaking to Jesse Noakes, who's a long-time homelessness support advocate. Jesse, I guess housing is only one part of the puzzle when it comes to addressing this issue for many, especially our Indigenous brothers and sisters. They're living very much in entrenched and generational poverty. What other, I guess, factors need to be addressed? As you said, that you know these 3,000-odd houses aren't even enough in terms of housing, but what else needs to be addressed in order to actually combat this crisis?
Very big question. I mean, my personal view, and one that I share with sort of with people I've been campaigning with and people on the streets, is that housing is the sort of the bottom layer. It's the foundation of stability and security and safety. A safe place to for families to raise their children is kind of the fundamental and most basic precondition for beginning to heal and repair and rebuild all the damage that's been done after many generations of colonisation and its impacts. I mean, I think higher up the pyramid, the child removal rates are obviously continuing to skyrocket, and WA is far and away the worst in the nation for removing Indigenous children from their parents as a proportion of the general population. Obviously, we are the mother of all jailers, as my friend Jerry Georgiadis regularly says, and we lock up more Indigenous people proportionally again than any other state in the country, and we see too many deaths in custody. And again, it's not just deaths in custody, deaths after custody. People are released into homelessness more often than they're released into accommodation. So, you know, more than 50% of people leaving prison, and in the case of Aboriginal people, more like 65% of people leaving prison do so onto the streets, or at best into extremely insecure accommodation at a friend's place or a relative's place. And without the stability of a home, I don't see how any of the other promises or rhetoric around closing the gap is worth the paper it's written on. It just doesn't mean anything. There's no way of improving health outcomes without that basic stability. If people are leaving hospital back onto the street, you can't heal. And the same applies to sort of to, you know, psychic and trauma scars in the same way. People need stability and they need security, and housing is, you know, the foundational layer that delivers that. On top of that, I think it's not just a matter of giving someone a home, of course. You need, you know, appropriate supports, culturally sensitive supports, and fundamentally, we just need to completely reframe and reorient how we work together as a society to support marginalised people and especially our Aboriginal and Noongar community to rebuild and heal from all the trauma that we've inflicted after generations of ripping them away from their country and their community and their culture and their parents, and then just basically saying, righto, get on with it. So I'd be, I'd say there's a fair bit more reparation that's owed. But hey, a few thousand houses for people who need the most is something.
It's a step in the right direction. Just finally on that, and you touched on that in terms of thinking about how we organise our society. I mean, many of these cuts to the so-called safety net and to social welfare really are the result of these decades of neoliberalism that we've been living under. I think that's, you know, it's not at all controversial to say that the neoliberal experiment has certainly failed the poor, failed the environment, failed our Indigenous brothers and sisters, failed women and pretty much anyone, unless you're a very, very wealthy, industry baron. I mean, is that, I guess, at the heart of this, you know, that, you know, we can make these steps towards public housing, towards social services, but fundamentally at the core of this is an economic model that both major parties have adopted, and that is leaving all issues to the market, all social, environmental and economic justice issues to the market to solve. And that's clearly not working, clearly has failed miserably. Do you think we need to really collectively address this from an ideological point of view, from a philosophical point of view, of, you know, and look at really changing the way in which we structure our society and view our sort of our privilege and view the other people in our society that are more marginalized by the system in which we live?
Quick answer, yes. And longer answer would probably take more thought than I'm immediately able to give it. I will just sort of answer through a lens, perhaps, and say that part of this announcement, the announcement was of 3,300 public houses, but it was framed as a social housing announcement. And I think that almost partially alludes to the problem you're talking about, the privatisation of the social safety net and the way in which public housing, which is most accountably and responsibly and best administered by the state and is the least, the very least, that the state owes these families who have had so much removed and destroyed from them by that state. It should not be then outsourced to NGOs and effectively sort of public-private partnerships to deliver and administer these homes. Social housing, in my view, is a bit of a misnomer. It's somewhat antisocial to seek to kind of to carve off this basic function of a state, especially, as I say, at sort of a, on in a place where we are, that's the very, very front line of colonisation and the pointy end of its impacts. I think, you know, housing's one thing. What happens after that is another. Many families who have lost children on the streets recently have done so because they were evicted from homes. And part of that is a total incapacity of our, you know, colonizer society to accept and adapt to and appreciate the far more sophisticated and rich ways that the First Nations peoples, the Noongar community in Perth's case, live and interact on this country and with each other. And I think clearly, you know, the homelessness crisis is a very immediate crisis and one that I've been focusing on recently. There are broader, bigger, longer, older crises than just this. But, I mean, homelessness and home and rootedness and connection to the place we're in is fundamental, arguably, to all of them and ought to unite our responses. And I think we need to stop telling people how they need to live and the laws they need to abide by and actually start listening to the laws that, you know, people have been here far, far, far longer than myself have managed to, you know, cohesively and responsibly live comfortably in their environment without doing the sort of damage that us wanderers have done since we rocked up and crashed the party in the very recent past. Bit of a messy, incoherent, arguably long answer, but yeah, absolutely. I think we should be listening rather than directing. And, you know, hopefully the basic safety net and foundation of a safe home for a few thousand of these families provides them with healing and rebuilding capacity, and then maybe some of us will start listening to the wisdom that they carry with them and actually start building long-term sustainable solutions that benefit everyone.
We've been speaking to Jesse Noakes, who's an indie media journalist, contributor, and a long-time homelessness support advocate. Thank you very much for speaking to us this morning, Jesse.
Good on you, mate. Appreciate the opportunity, as always. See you soon.
And this is the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1. That's about all we have time for this morning for this week's edition of the program. Thanks so much for coming in, Brent, and delivering that really insightful and, I guess, a somewhat depressing story on the 501 the visas and the people who are languishing in our detention system.
Yeah, it was. It is quite depressing, but I think if we can take any positives, it's that, you know, places like this, RTRFM and local radio, not just here but around the country, that's where we can talk about these issues. So that's something. And like you said earlier today, at least there was some positive news. I'm still personally buzzing about the logging decision last week from the state government, so at least we got to celebrate that.
Totally. And massive thanks to Jess Beckling for joining us from the West Australian Forest Alliance to discuss that, and also the Indie Media contributor, Jesse Noakes, for talking about the recent announcement of 3,300 public homes being built in our state. But obviously the fight is not over in that regard. As I said, that's about all we've got time for on the program today. We'll be back next week at 11 a.m. If you enjoyed the show, you can always restream it at rtrfm.com.au. You can listen to a lot of our individual interviews from over the years up on our SoundCloud, and the program's also available as a podcast via RTRFM. You can always get in touch with us via the studio, or if you're into the corporate social media, if you've got a story you'd like us to cover, or you'd like to get involved in some capacity, please do get in touch. It's all about you being the media. But yeah, keep it locked to RTRFM as Tash is coming up very shortly with Out to Lunch. It's going to be a fantastic few hours of new music on your radio. And as I said, we'll be back next week. But we're going to leave you with a bit of The Tigers. This is a track from their 2008 release, Beautiful Forest. And this is their track, Heart Horse. But as we say every week on the Indie Media Show,
don't hate the media.
Become the media. Have a great day.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?